Linda, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us more about this memoir.
I was a very confused young woman living in Knoxville at the time. And my life, you know, I was 24 at a time when your life should be opening up, but mine was shutting down big time for a variety of reasons, which are in the book. Just so people know what kind of motivated me to leave Knoxville by joining the Peace Corps and going to the Gambia, which is a very small country in West Africa. So basically, I went with this idea. I was going to help people. I was going to have an adventure. And I was going to reinvent myself into this brand new, cool person that I felt like I wasn't at the time. You know, basically, I was going to find myself. Well, I went over to the Gambia, and after several weeks of training with the Peace Corps, I ended up in a very small, remote, very, very devout Muslim village. And there I promptly proceeded to lose myself because I was just freaking out. It was like about 400 people, and before I went to the Gambia or heard about the Gambia, I didn't even know there were Muslims in Africa. I thought it would just be Africa, you know, my kind of limited idea of Africa at the time. And this was a super devout village. It was founded by a marabou, which is a Muslim man, usually a man, I think always men. He was mystical. He was a mystic. He was also a healer. And he was also the head of the village. And he said what happened in the village. You know, his word was the word. You just did what he said. So I went to this place, and it was fairly poor, not the poorest of the villages, but they had this incredibly ornate mosque. And when I saw that mosque surrounded by mud huts with thatched roofs, I knew then that's how important Islam was in this little place called Medina. And Alhaji Baba had said, okay, we're not doing drumming and dancing here, and we're not doing traditional things like wrestling. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm never going to have any fun here, and it's just going to be terrible. And for a while, it was. It was kind of terrible. I would call it dissociating. And got super depressed. I found myself at one point, it was my first look-see of the village. It was a trip that we all volunteers take. They go to their village for a night, spend the night, and then go back and finish training. And I was on my way to this village, and I just felt like I was on the savannah. There was nothing there. Well, there was stuff there, but I couldn't differentiate what was there at the time. And I just found myself wanting to burst out crying. And I went, oh my God, what is going on with me, you know? Because the Peace Corps had warned us that some people will go to live in the bush and they'll lose it. They'll have psychotic breaks, you know, they'll have to be sent home.
And at that point, you were 24 years old, 24 plus,
yeah.
And this was the late 1970s.
Right, 1979. I think by that time I was 25, yeah. I just thought, what is wrong with me? So I go to this village, and people welcomed me very warmly, and I got a new name. The marabou gave me a name. I was called Senabu Jallo, which was, his last name was Jallo, which is a very common name in West Africa among the Fulani people. And Senabu was actually the name of one of Muhammad's daughters. I forget which one. Zainab. You'll hear that name often in the Middle East. But in Africa, in West Africa, they called it Senabu.
Talk more without giving too much away, because you tell it at length in the book, but mm-hmm. Talk more about the transformation from going there, being lost, to being found.
Oh, well, that did not happen overnight. So if you're a white person and you go live in, I can't speak for everywhere, but in a small African village. And I was the first volunteer in this village, so I was a novelty, and people would just stare at me all the time. Wherever I went out in my hut, you know, it was Senabu, Senabu. And everybody was watching what I was doing, and I started to get really, on one hand, you kind of feel like a minor celebrity. On the other hand, people are really watching you intently. So I was trying to figure out what I was going to do to help the village. And people were watching me, and I just started freaking out, and I was having trouble leaving my house. So I would go, and I had a few hours where I worked at the local dispensary, and I would just come home, and I would hole up in my house. Or alternatively, I would jump up, pack my backpack, and I didn't have a motorcycle yet, but I would start walking to the nearest main road to wait for a bush taxi to take me to the Peace Corps office and tell them to send me home. Well, one day that happened. I had left the village. I was walking. I was so relieved. I was going to go home. And then I stopped halfway, and I just started thinking about my next-door neighbor, who was this wonderful woman named Yasin Njai. And I thought, she won't know what happened to me. She'll just wonder why I just kind of disappeared. I turned around and went back, and as I was entering the village coming back, I was so bummed out about going back. And all of a sudden, I started missing my mother. I was just freaking out. I felt like I was 5 years old, like a little kid who's, you know, you've lost your mother at the mall or something. And I really missed my mother, and I ran into my house, locked the door, and just bawled, and just totally realized at that point why I had been wanting to cry as I went into the village the first time. And that evening I was with some women in their kitchen helping prepare dinner, and I just kept wanting to cry. It was unresolved grief over my mother and how she became after she and my father divorced. And that had happened when I was a senior in high school, so it had been 8 years. And I prided myself on being a strong, aware, enlightened, feminist person, independent. And I thought I had put all that behind me and dealt with it. Well, turned out I hadn't. You go to a small place like that, and there's no distractions. I didn't have any movies to watch or yoga class to go to or friends to hang out with. So I was really thrown in on myself during those hours that I was holed up in my hut. And so I realized it then, and that's when things started to slowly, very slowly change. It wasn't just that I was in this small village and, you know, experiencing culture shock. I was really dealing with some unresolved grief that came up at a time when I was by myself, very far from home. That was one pivotal turning point.
Explain the title.
Oh, The Geography of Desire has to do not just with physical desire, although that was part of it, but also the desire to belong, the desire to make a meaningful contribution to a community that I wasn't really a part of for a long time. It took a while to integrate into that culture. The desire to find meaningful work and to find belonging to the community, but also belonging to a person. Like, I was very lonely. My personal relationships were kind of messed up. My history, my track record wasn't great. So I was looking for a lot of different things. And the geography part comes from my home where I grew up in East Tennessee. I grew up in Oak Ridge, and then going to Africa, and then also Poland comes to figure into the story as well, because I meet a guy from Poland and we fall in love. So it's like everybody's geography of desire is different. It's like a configuration of place and what you're looking for and how you find it in a certain place or places with certain people.
How much of this memoir was drawing from what you might have written or photographed at the time, and how much were you trying to take yourself back to that time?
Oh, good question. It was both. I did have two journals, but interestingly, some of the pivotal events I never wrote down in my journal. They were just in my mind. I also had letters. I wrote a lot of letters. My sister and my mother saved all of them, so they returned my letters to me, and that helped. I did take a lot of photographs, so that helped as well. But I also went back to the Gambia in 1997, which was before I started writing the memoir. I went back for a visit, and actually that visit is part of the memoir. It's the last part. So that refreshed my memory a lot, too. I would talk to people, and we would reminisce, and it's funny how people remember things differently. So a lot of it was really in my mind. It was still very vivid. And I did reread my journals, reread the letters. I also had to do a lot of research because I wanted to provide context about the Gambia and what the Gambia is, what kind of country it is, what's West Africa. And when I went there in 79, and by the time I left in 82, there wasn't much available. The Gambia's claim to fame was it's where Alex Haley traced his roots to. So that's the first time I think people heard of the Gambia much. In fact, my village was about 10 miles north of Jufure, his village. So I wanted, I just started doing research because the internet had come along and a lot was available. And so I learned a lot about the Gambia going back.
How much was writing the memoir another layer of healing on top of the journey that you experienced in Africa and years since?
A lot. Because, I definitely healed a lot from, I guess you could call it the trauma of a bitter divorce between parents. And I wanted to bring up, I'll get to that question, but I wanted to bring up this term that Pauline Boss, she was a sociologist, she invented this term, ambiguous loss. She had been studying families of soldiers who didn't come home, and that's how she coined the term. So in my case, my mother was still physically present, but she became emotionally absent. And so Dr. Boss explains that when you have that, or the opposite, as in the case of a soldier who doesn't come home, that person, you don't know if he's dead or if he's in prison somewhere. He's physically absent, but he is emotionally present still to people who knew him. So she points out that when you have a loss of that kind, it's extremely hard to move on. And I never encountered her work until I was researching the memoir and stuff, and I went, oh my God, that explains why I was so stuck in Knoxville for so long and why I grieved the way I did just out of the blue when I went to the Gambia. But then on top of that, I felt when I came back from the Gambia, I really did for a long time. There were certain relationships that I go into in the memoir. I just felt haunted by it in a good way, but felt like there was just still things I didn't understand, why I had done certain things I had done, why other people had acted the way they did. So that was one reason I started writing the memoir. And writing a memoir is a little tricky because on the one hand, you have to really delve into your emotions to get at the emotional core of your life. On the other hand, you have to get distance so you can kind of look from your perspective now and look back on it and see it a little bit more objectively. Otherwise, you're not going to understand why you did what you did.
And with perspective in mind, do you think that you would ever return again?
No. I went back in 1997. I wouldn't hate to say never, but I went back in 1997 for about 3 weeks, and I pretty much got closure on everything at that point. And that's also in the memoir, at the very end.
And for people who want to know more about The Geography of Desire, by you, Linda Gamble, where can they go online?
Well, for one thing, Gamble, you spell my name, it's Scottish. It's G-A-M-B-I-L-L, not like gamble, like going to the casino. So I have a website, lindagamble.com, and the book is available on Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places.
All right. Linda, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Catch all our conversations on Scenic Routes at our website, wutc.org, on the WUTC app, and wherever you get your podcasts.